J6, number 2B.
We go on, and she says that theosophy is a corruption of Judaism. This corruption had its renewal in the Neoplatonic philosophy, but it sprang from the Oriental philosophy of Brahmanism and blends with its magic and enchantment. Theosophy is no more allied to Christian science than the odor of the upas tree is to the sweet breath of springtide, or the brilliant coruscations of the northern sky are to solar heat or light. She goes on to say, what is theosophy under the philosophy of karma? She says, the Christian scientists in Pulpit and Press are diametrically opposed to the philosophy of karma and of reincarnation, which are the tenets of theosophy. So basically, she's saying that this Oriental philosophy that is coming into the world today, which is so hot with the New Age, with the yoga and Buddhism and Hinduism, all these, Brahmanism, Shintoism, all these isms, basically have their basis in theosophy, whose tenets are karma and reincarnation. So you know that karma is that belief of rebirth, the cycle of birth and rebirth and birth and rebirth, that many, many reincarnated forms, that the belief is that man goes forward on this wheel of samsara. That, let's say, we are born into this world, and what we do has the effect of our afterlife when we're born back into this world again. Therefore, if when we're born into this world, we have good karma, we work happily and morally and are nice people, good humans, then we have good karma, because when we die and come back into the world again, we're on a higher standpoint, a higher system standpoint. But if we are born into the world and we've had bad karma, we've been evil, murderers, adulterers, and whatever, as the Bible says, just plain nasty, then we have bad karma. And then when we're born back into the world, we become lower. I don't know. I guess we could even become the lowest of animals, or whatever the belief is, that our stature in life, in position in life, is due to the philosophy of karma and reincarnation. Well, she says that's theosophy, basically, which is basically springs from Oriental philosophy, and that is not Christian science. We will see that man was never born into matter. He doesn't live in matter. He doesn't grow old in matter. He doesn't die out of matter. Man always has been spiritual and has never fallen out of grace. That is just a belief that we were born into matter, and that we have to handle that belief, that false sense that anything else has ever been going on for God. And that isn't easy, because from the physical standpoint, if we go out from that standpoint, we say, well, matter is real. Well, from that standpoint, it appears real. But from the spiritual standpoint, we're all as idea, matter never can be. If God is all in all, then how is there a place that there's anything else going on besides God? It has to go on within the realm of illusion or belief. So what we see is, again, this sixth chapter, which I have been preparing for 2 years now with two classes on it. It's so terrific. But in it, Mrs. Eddy really brings out so clearly, as she does in the whole textbook, that this is all goes on in belief. But whereas Oriental philosophy makes it real, human philosophy makes that realm of the mental and matter real. It builds on a two-valued logic. The Aristotelian logic is a logic that makes the spiritual real and the material real. The two values are real. Good is real and evil is real. So it's that duality of all philosophies except Jesus' philosophy, all other philosophies which embrace the material sciences work with duality, the good and evil. The spirit is real and matter is real. But to Mrs. Eddy, she says, no, only the spirit is real. Matter is unreal. So So she, instead of having a two-valued logic where two of the values are real, she has a dual conceptual logic that only one value is real, the spiritual, and the material is unreal. So she works with real and unreal, with fact and counterfeit. We never see in Mrs. Eddy's logic fact and counterfact. She doesn't have that there's a counterfact. She only works with facts, truth, and counterfeits, false beliefs. It's a different logic than the Aristotelian logic. So it's totally different. It's revolutionary. It's radical. It's different. And we've got to stick up for that difference. Last year, I kept going over and over and pounding in this sense that Christian Science is different. And I was quoting from Prose Work where she says, "Go to the scaffold if you must, but take not back the words of truth." I kept wanting to show that, well, that it is so radical that we've got to stick up for what we do. Yes, we know that Christian Science isn't that we have to sacrifice the human body or sacrifice our life for the spiritual, that if we go out from the Gabriel sense of consciousness that all is spiritual, that that falls away. But the point is we have to have radical reliance on the truth and know it. It's different. Today in the world, everybody loves getting along. See, it's going to be this false sense of brotherhood. Come, let us all reason together, and we're going to get this whole hodgepodge, as we'll see, in the mental realm of every ism and ology is all thrown in together, defined under a new age. Well, it isn't a new age. It's an old age revisited. It's all these old isms and ologies of Oriental philosophy and Grecian philosophy. It's everything all jumbled up. When you go into a New Age bookshop and you look into their books, everything's there. Everything. Well, see, that to them is being open. We're narrow-minded in Christian Science. That's, I suppose they would call it a cult, but it isn't what we do, a cult, and we're not narrow-minded. We work with science and categories, and categories differentiate what is real from what is unreal. You can't just lump it all together. That a science differentiates. That makes the difference between a science and mysticism. Mysticism is just an amorphous whole. There's just everything, this big hodgepodge. No differentiation. It's all just wonderful and simply divine. It's all God going on. Well, that's a danger. That's what mysticism is, the union mystical. It's all good. If God is all in all, then everything's wonderful. Now, you accept everything. And nobody likes us when we say, oh, no, that in a science, science differentiates. That's the point of a science. It differentiates to bring order. A science takes all this infinite information and begins to say, this is a point one, this is a point two, this is a point three, this is a point four, this is a point five. It categorizes. And when you categorize and get order, you get laws. And you get different categories. And so we, in a science, always says, well, this category now is real, working with real values. This is unreal, working with false values. It has to differentiate. It's not a science. So science comes into the world and will take all this jumble of information and begin to categorize it. Now, that isn't always popular because everybody wants you to go along with what they do. But science is tolerant. There's a difference between accepting what somebody does and being tolerant of what they do. I think Mahatma Gandhi was one of the big ones to preach tolerance. Well, that's true. Any spiritual person on a journey spiritual as Jesus was tolerant of the mental realm and tolerant of the physical realm, meaning that, like Mrs. Eddy says in Prose Works, she says, God, how does she say that? Something's talking about the regulator of mankind, and then says that God gets after us for trying to adjust what he adjusts. Meaning that God is at work with the regulator of mankind. The Christ idea is bringing mankind from the physical realm, into the mental realm, out of human philosophy, into divine philosophy. We don't do it, so we have to be tolerant. We don't accept it, but we're tolerant that the Christ idea will take away the false beliefs. and take the world into reality. So we aren't going in there as the old Christians did and preach to mankind and take them out of a value system which they are finding a value at the moment. The Christ appears in many different ways, but they will be taken out by the Christ idea into the higher realm. We're not to interfere. We're just to be at work in divine science and live by example. And have the system available when the people are ready for it. But we certainly aren't in there to moralize or preach. So we have to live by example and see that the Christ is bringing human philosophy out of itself into the divine. But we are not in that jumble. So she already differentiated then also human philosophy, now the doctrines of Oriental philosophy, all based on theosophy. And in these various other quotes I gave, you could certainly see how she showed Christian Science has nothing to do with the doctrine of Buddha. And Buddha, you know, is one of the ones where they try to show that Buddha himself was okay. I mean, see, Buddha came out of Hinduism. And he was born a Hindu, but in Hinduism very strongly into the reality of spirit and matter. And through Hinduism, you do all various fastings, etc., to become spiritual. But Buddha saw that you could have enlightenment. And so he did come out from enlightenment, finding your true identity, and had some very, as Mrs. Eddy said, these people have glimpses of the spiritual. But she says here of the doctrine of Buddha, she says, the doctrine of Buddha, which rests on a heathen basis for its nirvana, presents not the divinity of Christian Science, in which truth or Christ finds its paradise in spirit, in the consciousness of heaven within us, health, harmony, holiness, entirely apart from the limitations which would dwarf individuality and personality and couple evil with good, still showing that that doctrine of Buddha is not the whole Christ truth. It's still limitations. It still dwarfs that identity which Buddha so said, to free your identity, to free your individuality. She says that still his teachings couple evil with good. So she says, to show that, she says, in science we learn that man is not absorbed in the divine nature, but absolved by it. Man is free from the flesh and is individual in consciousness, in mind, not in matter. Think not that Christian Science tends towards Buddhism or any other ism. Per contra, Christian Science destroys such tendency. So the doctrine of Buddha tending more and more towards individuality and the limitations and the absorption of it more and more into the nirvana, the absorption of that individuality into the undifferentiated whole. That Christian Science doesn't absorb into the undifferentiated whole where you can get the danger of mixing spirit with matter. So we see then that she draws this big line of demarcation. Now, when we go into this concept, and as I say, we're spending time with this point of philosophy because I've named the class The Science of Christian Science, The Emergence of a Divine Philosophy. So we want to know that Mrs. Eddy gave a divine philosophy and that what now is the inner meaning of the terms philosophy. So we're just going to look a little closer into this. Because we will see that, as I mentioned last evening, that it's philosophy that gives you the world view. That big Weltanschauung, that's German for Welt, world, Anschauung view. Philosophy is always that gives the world view from which the sciences work. You need the view first. Is that world view, as I said last night, material? If it is, then you get a material science. If the worldview is mental, then you're going to get a mental science. If the worldview is spiritual, then you're going to get a spiritual science. But the most important thing is the worldview, the philosophy. It's the bigger category, as I said last night. So when we look up this meaning of philosophy, and Dave asked for the meaning of philos or philo, what I found out, and I didn't bring with me just for the sake of travel from the on the airplane, that book on origins by Partridge, which is so good for the root origin of words, but I have with me, and that when I had looked it up originally, was that it's from the Greek, philos meaning loving wisdom. And of course, ophi is always the study of wisdom. So that's what I found. What do you have, Dave? Did you find? Good. Good. Knowledge. Yeah, that's wonderful. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. And that's what it is. So you see, what tone of the synonyms, for those of us who are old hands and we have our new students, it doesn't matter. Sometimes if we, because we have different levels of class here of students, what tone of the synonymous terms would be in that loving of knowledge or the loving of wisdom? What do we hear? Love is? Life, yes, laying down the mortal concept, and also that sense of pre-established perfection made known, love itself. It can also be the coupling of love, life and love there, yes, uh-huh. And wisdom is? Huh? Mind. So it's a coupling of life and love, life, truth, and love with mind. So we see then that if we look up this, as Dave did then, and I just had it from the American Heritage Dictionary, then went on to define it as the root meaning the love of wisdom, then you have the love and pursuit of wisdom. It defined it by what means? How is that love and pursuit of wisdom investigated? The dictionary says, by intellectual means and moral self-discipline. That's what American Heritage said. So that we have the love and pursuit of wisdom by intellectual means, there's mind, and moral self-discipline. There's a sense of a spiritual nature, spiritual values. So we investigate the love of wisdom through mind and spirit here, through intellectual means and moral self-discipline and through moral values. And it says that a philosophy, that the love and pursuit of wisdom, it also defines it as the investigation of causes and laws underlying reality based on logical reasoning. See? So the love of wisdom is pursued by intellectual means and moral self-discipline, and by the investigation of causes and laws which underlie reality based on logical reasoning. Again, mind, huh, that the love and pursuit of wisdom is based on logical reasoning. So we see that that whole philosophy is the love of wisdom, which is pursued by intellectual means, by logical reasoning and moral standards. Then it goes on, and we say to ourselves, through what we read, just asking questions. Also, Weizsäcker, a German scientist philosopher, says that philosophy means also asking fundamental questions, which is also what a science does. So we ask ourselves then, do we need a philosophy? And from what Mrs. Eddy says, yes, we do. Because she says Christian Science is revolutionary. We need a worldview. We can't get along without a philosophy. How can we get along without a worldview? It's impossible. We all need a central order. We all need some principle. We all need some philosophy from which to go out from. Everyone. As even Heisenberg said, everyone needs some type of worldview to govern their life. So we need one, yes. And so then we saw then that what we need is a divine philosophy, not a human philosophy which is based on duality of the belief that spirit is real and matter is real, that good is real and evil is real, on the two-valued logic of Aristotle. We need a divine philosophy Now, how did she define the divine philosophy? Well, if we were attentive to what she was saying, that she would give us four big points about a divine philosophy. She would say that a divine philosophy has four aspects. First, that it needs a postulate of the divine principle God. That's what she said. We read there in Miscellaneous Writings 364. She says, Christian Science refutes everything that is not a postulate of the divine principle God. That's the word. Whenever you get a statement of the divine principle God, that's the word. So divine philosophy needs a statement about the divine principle God. So first of all, her philosophy will give us what God is, a statement. Her philosophy will always start from God. That's the point of the word there. So if we just take point by point, let's take first here, then that every divine philosophy starts from God, reasons from God. That's her big point, reasoning from cause to effect. We begin with mind. We begin with God. We begin with spiritual values. We begin with what is real. And she defined God as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. So every philosophy must reason from mind, from spirit, from soul, from principle, from life, truth, and love. And how much do we reason always from mind in its ideas to the universe? How do we always see the universe from spirit and its ideas? Do we let soul identify the universe? How often do we identify the universe from what principle says about the universe? That the divine principle must interpret the universe. Do we interpret the universe from life? Do we interpret the universe from truth? Do we interpret it from love? Mostly no. We mostly interpret the universe from mortal mind, from matter, from sense testimony, from personality, from life and death, from sickness, from fear, hate, jealousy. That's how we usually look at the world and try to reverse it because we don't like it. But she says in our divine philosophy, we must interpret the universe from principle God. Start with God. Every divine philosophy must do that. That's how our love of wisdom reasoning goes. Then she gives the next point of a divine philosophy, where she talks about how a divine philosophy is the true idea of the Christ. So she says that in No and Yes, where we read, divine philosophy is demonstrably the true idea of the Christ. So we see then that that word in a divine philosophy, we must start from God, start from the divine principle God, from the statement of God. And that has a Christ, that statement of what God is as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, that comes to every single situation. It has a Christ. That philosophy heals and saves. And you know, she shows in what we read that that was a problem with the Greeks. The Grecian philosophy, she says there, never brought mankind forward. It's still in the same problems it always was. Always presenting its thesis and then its antithesis. And then its antithesis becomes another thesis, which becomes another antithesis, which becomes another thesis, which becomes another antithesis. And the philosophy has just become an intellectual exercise. And it hasn't brought mankind forward. If any of us have taken classes in philosophy, and like I have at the university, well, I couldn't stand it any longer. Suddenly somebody would come along with a fairly intelligent approach to reality, and then immediately somebody else would come along and refute it with an antithesis. And then you'd say, well, all right, because out of that thesis and antithesis, you'd get a synthesis. And then from that synthesis, you'd say, well, that's not too bad. And then from that synthesis became the new thesis, which then suddenly somebody would come along and argue against it, which became an antithesis. And you just had that struggle between thesis and antithesis and synthesis, which became your thesis, antithesis, synthesis. It never resolved itself. It just goes on and on within that realm of human mind. It just doesn't, it's no savior. It has not saved the world, she says. What has Kant's categories done for the world? Nothing. It's fun to go sit in a coffee house and talk about it, as an intellectual in the wrong sense does. It makes for interest and stimulation, but it never gets to the point. It never heals. It never has a messiah. It's only a divine philosophy based on the divine mind has a messiah, a Christ, this true idea, you see? That's so important. She'll bring that over and over again, that it's only the divine philosophy going out from the divine mind that is the Messiah that heals. Nothing else heals. No other philosophy heals.